Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Procedures Enriching the Merits Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 25, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Trevino v. Thaler and McQuiggins v. Perkins. Both cases involve procedural issues relating to habeas proceedings. The question in McQuiggins is whether, under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, there's an actual innocence exception to the requirement that a petitioner show an extraordinary circumstance that prevented timely filing of a habeas petition, and, if so, whether there's an additional actual innocence exception to the requirement that a petitioner demonstrate that he has been pursuing his rights diligently. The question in Trevino involves the court's 2012 decision in Martinez v. Ryan, which holds that the ineffective assistance of counsel in state post-conviction proceedings with regard to claims that could not be raised on direct appeal excuses the defendant's failure to raise such claims in the state post-conviction proceedings and therefore allows him to raise them for the first time in a subsequent federal habeas proceeding. The question in Trevino is whether Martinez applies when it is unclear under state law whether the claims in question could have been raised on direct appeal. To discuss the cases, we have Ward Campbell, who is the supervising Deputy Attorney General of the California Department of Justice. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Campbell.
After defendants are convicted, their cases are reviewed on appeal, on state habeas corpus, and then on federal habeas corpus. On appeal, defendants may claim that legal errors occurred at trial, but their claims are limited by the actual record of the trial. Claims cannot be based on evidence outside that record. On state habeas corpus, defendants have the latitude to raise claims based on new evidence and new records. This is why habeas corpus is often referred to as collateral review. In federal court, defendants can raise all of the issues on appeal and state habeas corpus that were rejected by the state courts. A recurring theme in our system of criminal justice is finality. When will the litigation finally come to an end? At what point does the state's and victim's interest in finality outweigh the defendant's interest in reviewing all possible challenges to their conviction? Two cases argued in the Supreme Court of the United States on February 25, 2013, dealt with the question of finality, albeit in different contexts. But both cases at bottom involve what happens when defendants fail to timely raise claims on habeas, whether they will still get a chance to raise their late claims. The first case, McQuiggins v. Perkins, arose in Michigan. It also deals with another important issue, innocence, and whether Mr. Perkins could use alleged evidence of his innocence to file a late petition for writ of habeas corpus in federal court. It is often asked, is innocence relevant? The answer is, well, yes and no. First, defendants may claim that they have discovered new evidence of their innocence, but there is no allegation that the state or the courts have committed any error or that they received an unfair trial. This is a freestanding claim of innocence, and the Supreme Court so far has never held that such a claim can be raised in federal court, since the Constitution guarantees a fair process, but not necessarily an accurate result. Rather, pure claims of innocence are matters for the state courts and for state governors as part of their historic power of executive clemency. Second, however, federal courts do entertain innocence claims in other contexts. For instance, if defendants procedurally forfeit a claim in state court, such as by failing to object, the federal courts will respect state rules and not consider those claims. This is called the procedural default rule, and it is an important rule in terms of bringing finality to these cases. But the federal courts make an exception when a defendant has also made a showing of actual innocence, showing that it is more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted the defendant in light of the new evidence. In those cases, they allow the defendant to raise the claim that they had previously forfeited in state court. Finally, there are statutory exceptions to limitations on habeas corpus relief based on actual innocence. When Congress enacted the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, or AEDPA, it limited the ability of defendants to file successive petitions or to get evidentiary hearings. Defendants may get around these limitations if they introduce evidence underlying a claim that would be sufficient to establish by clear and convincing evidence that no reasonable fact finder would have found the defendants guilty. Defendants must also demonstrate that they were diligent in presenting this evidence and did not just sit on it. Now, AEDPA also has another limitation on habeas corpus relief. a one-year period of limitations for filing a petition. There are four separate triggering events for this period of limitations. The main one is that defendants must file their federal petitions 1 year after they finish review in state court. There is also another triggering event of 1 year after the date on which the factual predicate for a claim could have been discovered with due diligence. The Supreme Court has also ruled that Congress intended that the period of limitations may be equitably tolled, that the one-year clock may stop for a time when, despite due diligence, extraordinary circumstances prevent a defendant from filing their petitions on time. But there is no statutory exception for the period of limitations simply because of the belated discovery of evidence of actual innocence. Perkins needs the Supreme Court to create that exception, and he needs it badly. Perkins was convicted of murdering his friend Henderson in 1993. The main witness against Perkins was another friend, Jones. Jones claimed he was present when Perkins suddenly pulled out a knife and stabbed Henderson to death right in front of him. The jury rejected Perkins' attempt to pin the murder on Jones. Michigan State Court review of Perkins' conviction became final on May 5, 1997. Under the federal statute of limitations, Perkins had 1 year until May 5, 1998 to file a federal petition for writ of habeas corpus. Perkins didn't. Instead, in 1997, he got an affidavit from his sister that she had heard that Jones had admitted stabbing Henderson and taken his bloody clothes to the cleaners. Then, in 1999, Perkins got an affidavit from one of his friend's younger brothers stating that Jones secretly admitted stabbing Henderson the night of the murder and had blood on his clothing. Finally, in 2002, Perkins found the dry cleaning clerk and got an affidavit that Jones had come to the shop around the date of Henderson's murder with bloody clothing. Despite this, Perkins still waited until 2008, 11 years after his case was final in state court, to file his petition for writ of habeas corpus in federal court. Obviously, this posed a problem for Perkins since the one-year period of limitations for filing habeas corpus petitions had long run out on him. Nevertheless, Perkins still argued that the federal district court should consider his petition. He based his argument on decisions of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that held that the period of limitations would not apply if a petitioner made a showing of actual innocence. The federal district court denied Perkins' petition because Perkins had failed to exercise due diligence in presenting his evidence and because he had failed to show actual innocence. The district court noted that the new evidence had been substantially available to Perkins at trial, and his defense at trial was that he was being framed. Parenthetically, I should add that the actual holding of the federal district court on actual innocence is subject to disagreement among the parties, and that disagreement may affect the outcome in this case. Perkins appealed. In order to appeal the denial of a habeas, defendants such as Perkins must get a certificate of appealability specifying the issues the appeals court will consider. The appeal is limited to those issues. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals did not issue a certificate on Perkins' claim of actual innocence, but did issue a certificate to hear his claim that he did not need to show that he exercised due diligence. The appeals court rejected the district court's holding that Perkins needed to show diligence. Yet, even though no certificate was issued on the innocence issue, the appeals court reiterated that a showing of actual innocence could trump the period of limitations, and it remanded Perkins' case to the district court to fully consider Perkins' evidence. Second parenthetical, the Sixth Circuit's treatment of the innocence issue is another source of disagreement among the parties, and that disagreement may also affect the outcome of this case. The Supreme Court granted Michigan's petition for writ of certiorari on the question of whether the statute of limitations could be avoided completely by a showing of actual innocence, an issue which has caused a split in the federal circuits, and also the question of whether such a showing had to be made with diligence. Michigan's main argument is that Congress was clearly aware of the actual innocence exception when it passed AEDPA. Congress chose to create such an exception for successive petitions and for evidentiary hearings, but it omitted an actual innocence exception for the statute of limitations. Hence, it did not intend for these limitations to be abrogated by belated showings of innocence. Furthermore, when Congress did enact an innocence exception in AEDPA, it also required due diligence. Perkins also relied on the Supreme Court's jurisprudence for an actual innocence exception, but he came to the opposite conclusion. He argued that the court must presume that there was an actual innocence exception to the statute of limitations unless Congress explicitly provided to the contrary. As support for this, he analogized to the earlier Supreme Court decision, which held that the period of limitations could be equitably tolled because of a longstanding rule of statutory construction that equitable tolling should be presumed unless Congress expressly prohibited it. He noted that the actual innocence standard had never required diligence, that actual innocence is the ultimate equitable trump card. He also noted that Congress could not have intended to permit exceptions for actual innocence for successive petitions, but not for first petitions. At most, delay in presenting that evidence should be taken into account in assessing the credibility of the evidence of actual innocence, and diligence should not be required. The oral argument reflected a lack of consensus on these questions and concerns about the record and procedural history of Perkins' case. In particular, Justices Alito, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor all had skeptical questions about how the District Court and the Sixth Circuit had handled the question of actual innocence. Michigan agreed with Justice Alito that the District Court had rejected Perkins' claim of actual innocence, but Michigan also had to agree that the actual innocence issue was never properly before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. This, of course, could be a reason for the court not to hear that issue at all. Michigan insisted, however, that the court was within its rights to reach the merits question as to whether actual innocence should be an exception to the period of limitations. Tellingly, Justice Ginsburg later noted during Perkins' argument that it did not seem to matter to the Sixth Circuit at all whether Perkins' claim of actual innocence had a solid basis, and she wanted to know whether the Sixth Circuit should have made that determination before returning the case to the District Court. That carried the implication that the Supreme Court could also make that determination. As to the actual merits questions, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer posed questions which favored interpreting AEDPA to include an actual innocence exception for the period of limitations. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito were both skeptical that Congress intended such an exception. Justice Alito described Perkins' position as a, quote, very big exception, unquote, to the period of limitation that was inconsistent with AEDPA. While it was true that such claims rarely prevailed, they were frequently made. Justice Alito opined that a lot of prisoners would be able to come up with evidence equal to the evidence Perkins had produced, a showing that Justice Alito evidently did not consider very credible. Chief Justice Roberts could see situations in which a prisoner would have an incentive to delay raising a claim of actual innocence until it was too late for the state to refute it. As to diligence, Justices Breyer and Sotomayor were uncertain how to write an opinion that would prevent prejudicial delay. Their question suggested that the rule should only preclude sham, deliberate, or contrived delay of such claims. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito also questioned whether Perkins was diligent in presenting his evidence of actual innocence. Justice Scalia was essentially silent, and Justice Thomas, as is his practice, asked no questions. You can make some educated guesses about the opinions of the individual justices on the outcome. Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer seemed sympathetic to creating such an exception. It would be reasonable to assume that Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, oppose it because they're concerned about further delay in federal habeas litigation. Justice Kennedy's questions, on the other hand, were not particularly revealing. And significantly, Justice Ginsburg's questions focused a great deal on the procedural posture of the case below, and she was not alone with those concerns. Despite the circuit split on this issue, some of the justices may want to avoid deciding whether there is an actual innocence exception to the period of limitations, with or without diligence, and simply wait until another day. For instance, due to the procedural uncertainties below, the court might dismiss the case as improvidently granted. Given the tenor of the oral argument, another way to postpone these issues is to reject Perkins' showing of actual innocence. Find it unnecessary to reach the question of whether such an exception should exist at all. Notably, there were no questions favoring the substance of Perkins' actual innocence claim. That is not very surprising. Perkins' claim of actual innocence really boils down to an affidavit from one of his friend's younger brothers that Jones secretly admitted stabbing Henderson the night of the murder. The other evidence that Jones had blood in his clothing hardly excludes Perkins as a stabber. Jones could have been bloodied simply by standing nearby, as he testified. More importantly, the prosecution's case was not based just on Jones. There was evidence from other witnesses that Perkins fantasized about stabbing someone, that he suspected Henderson of snitching, repeatedly threatened to kill Henderson, and admitted murdering Henderson afterwards. It seems unlikely that Perkins' one belated affidavit meets the extraordinary standard of showing that it is more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted Perkins in light of the new evidence. As Justice Alito observed during oral argument, the most that is suggested by the affidavits is that Jones was a participant in this murder, not that Perkins was not responsible for the murder. Perhaps the court will just leave it at that. Now I would like to turn to the second case argued on February 25th, Trevino v. Thaler. Unlike Perkins, Trevino was sentenced to death, but his case had a more typical procedural history. He was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. He was represented by counsel at trial, and then he was appointed new separate counsel for appeal and state habeas corpus. Trevino's death judgment was affirmed by the Texas Court of Appeals, and it also denied his first state habeas corpus petition. With new counsel, Trevino then filed a second state habeas corpus petition in which he claimed for the first time that his trial attorney ineffectively failed to investigate, develop, and present mitigating evidence at his penalty phase. The Texas court rejected this claim on the state procedural ground that Trevino had abused the writ by not raising the issue in his first petition. Trevino filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus in federal court and again claimed that his trial attorney had been effective in the penalty phase. Texas argued that the federal court could not consider the ineffective assistance of counsel claim because the Texas court had rejected the claim on independent state procedural grounds, the procedural default doctrine. The district court agreed with Texas. Trevino was not able to argue that he should be excused from the procedural default because of ineffective assistance of counsel on his first state habeas. In 1989, the Supreme Court had held in a case called Coleman v. Thompson that since defendants had no constitutional right to counsel on habeas, that any errors by those counsel could not excuse procedural defaults on state habeas. This is to be distinguished from errors made by counsel at trial or on appeal, since there is a constitutional right to representation during those phases of the criminal process. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals also upheld the district court. Trevino's case might have ended there, despite his claims that his appointed counsel on his first habeas ineffectively failed to challenge his trial court counsel's penalty phase performance. But the rules were about to change, and Trevino's case would be heard by the Supreme Court. While Trevino's case was still pending, the Supreme Court issued its 7-2 opinion in an Arizona case, Ryan v. Martinez. The issue in Martinez was whether a prisoner in a state which prohibited raising a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal, but did permit that claim to be raised in a first state habeas corpus proceeding, could be excused from raising a claim in that first proceeding because of ineffective assistance of habeas corpus counsel. The Supreme Court held that in those narrow circumstances in which the state barred raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal did allow them to be raised in an initial review collateral proceeding, such as state habeas corpus, that a procedural default in that first collateral proceeding would not bar a federal habeas court from hearing claims about ineffective assistance of counsel at trial that were not raised in the first habeas proceeding because of the ineffectiveness of the habeas counsel. On its own terms, Martinez's effect was limited because a few states prohibited raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal. But in dissent, Justice Scalia predicted that the supposedly narrow rule of Martinez would expand to include exceptions for claims which by their nature could only be brought on habeas corpus, not on appeal. The implication of Justice Scalia's dissent was clear. Claims such as ineffective assistance of counsel could rarely be raised on appeal because the record on appeal rarely had the information or evidence necessary to litigate those claims. By its own logic, or to use Justice Breyer's words, rationale, the Martinez rule could not remain limited to the few states which outright prohibited raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal. Justice Scalia's dissent now appears prophetic in light of the court's questions at the oral argument in Trevino v. Thaler, an oral argument, incidentally, in which Justice Scalia remained unusually silent, except for sarcastically reminding his colleagues of his Martinez dissent by referring to the question before the court as to whether there should now be a new rule called Martinez Plus. As I said, Trevino was from Texas. Unlike Arizona, Texas does not prohibit raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal, although it also hears such claims on state habeas corpus. The question before the court was whether Martinez should remain limited to the narrow circumstances of a state which completely prohibited raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal, such as Arizona, or whether it should look to see if a state system effectively operated to channel those claims into state habeas corpus, even if it also did allow them to be raised on appeal. The oral argument illustrated the difficulty for the court in that regard, as it questioned counsel not only about the Texas system, but also about the systems in Kansas, Michigan, and Utah. Trevino's position focused on the procedural impediments in the Texas system to raising ineffective assistance of counsel at trial claims. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor wanted to know whether the line should be drawn for states that expressed a preference for raising these claims by habeas or placed procedural impediments that made it difficult to raise the claims on appeal. Justice Kagan questioned whether the issue turned on the amount of time an appellate attorney would have to augment a record on appeal with new records regarding counsel's performance. Justices Kennedy, Alito, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor all wanted to know how to write a rule that would not require courts to analyze each separate and distinct state system. The justices and Trevino's counsel posited different formulations, such as whether the state system made it impracticable to raise ineffective assistance of counsel claims in appeal, or whether the prisoner was given a full and fair opportunity to raise the claim on appeal. Justices posed questions about variations on the Texas system and other state systems, but Trevino's attorney conceded that under most variations, Martinez should now apply. Indeed, someone hearing the argument might conclude that Utah is about the only state that might not be affected by Trevino's reformulation of Martinez. The court's questions to Texas assumed their conclusion, that the court would expand Martinez beyond states which prohibited raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial on appeal. It was not a matter of whether the court would do it, it was simply a matter of how to do it. Although Texas maintained it was sufficient for Texas to avoid the Martinez rule because Texas procedure permitted raising claims of ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal, the Texas Solicitor General was immersed in questions as to how the Texas system worked. Most of the justices' questions reflected the perception that the Texas system favored channeling ineffective assistance of counsel claims into state habeas corpus. Both Justices Kennedy and Breyer were obviously placing great reliance on the Texas State Bar Brief, which was considered critical of the Texas system. Justices Ginsburg and Kennedy opined that since Texas paid habeas counsel more than appellate counsel, that this also reflected the expectation that ineffective assistance of counsel claims could be litigated on habeas. Justices Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer suggested that Texas courts expressed a preference for hearing claims of ineffective assistance of counsel on habeas corpus rather than allowing them to use Texas procedures to augment their record on appeal. Answers to questions by Justices Breyer, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Alito disclosed that the Texas appeal process was rarely used to litigate ineffective assistance of counsel at trial claims. Justice Kennedy's questions indicated he was being driven by how the system worked in capital cases. Kennedy asked specifically whether a court of appeals had ever remanded a capital case to supplement the record on appeal. The Texas Solicitor General was aware of no capital cases in which that had occurred. Later, the Texas Solicitor General also stated he could not indicate any capital cases in which counsel had been found ineffective for failing to investigate and presenting mitigating evidence in a penalty phase as part of a Texas appeal. When the Texas Solicitor General cited a case as an example of prisoners raising ineffective assistance of counsel at trial claims and appeal, Justice Kagan essentially brushed the case off as non-representative and contrary to Texas's position. She cited Martinez as an equitable rule and questioned why it should not apply since the Texas system only provided a technical possibility of raising ineffective assistance of counsel claims on appeal. Despite the efforts of the Texas Solicitor General to maintain the bright-line rule in Martinez, the tone of the court's questioning was that the application of Martinez will now turn on an actual analysis of the state review system and when claims of ineffective assistance of counsel at trial can effectively be litigated. Most likely, Justice Kennedy, who authored Martinez, as well as the other justices in the Martinez majority, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Breyer, and Kagan, will vote to expand Martinez to include Texas. Their challenge is what kind of rule they will write. If their rule can avoid state-by-state analysis and not be all-encompassing, then Justice Alito, who was also in the Martinez majority, may likely join. Chief Justice Roberts' vote or dissent is harder to predict. His questioning, at least, suggested that he was looking for a way to maintain the Martinez bright-line rule, but he was largely alone in asking those questions. Since Justices Scalia and Thomas dissented in Martinez, they can be expected to dissent to Martinez plus and to predict that the next case would now produce Martinez double plus. One way or another, for better or worse, the oral argument indicates that despite the court's promise the day of the narrow, limited Martinez rule will be short-lived, hardly a year. And to echo Justice Scalia's dissent in Martinez, noticeably absent from the oral argument were any questions relating to the comity and respect the federal courts must accord state court judgment, and any concern that a criminal conviction ought to be final before society has forgotten the crime that justifies it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.